Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We just actually finished Section 8, the enumerated powers, yesterday. Now, I know it spanned, 2 days of our time, but let me ask you this. Go back over those, or actually go through them. And what I would ask you to try to find for me is anywhere where they have been, where the federal government, Congress, has been enumerated the power or has been delegated the power over education, the Department of Transportation to be able to control all roads, waterways, airways, and so forth, to control communications, to control, other than the Postal Service, to control, let's say, housing, to control agriculture, to control labor, to control healthcare, welfare. Each of these executive departments, there are 12 of them, and I only listed about half or maybe a little more, they do not have the enumerated power. So what that means is that that is how broad and how wide the tyranny has gotten with the general government. Now, here's the problem. Too many people don't know this, even people within the general government. And when you tell them that they're doing unconstitutional things, they look at you like a threat. Remember my premise. Reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. The fact of the matter is that they have been bamboozled. They've been lied to that what they are doing is legitimate. If they are taught the facts, they will recognize that what they are doing is wrong and illegal. It goes against the fundamental principles of how our republic was established by the framers. Unfortunately, there are too many people today without the scruples and with those, I will say, the necessary morals, the necessary integrity. And why is that? It's because they took control of the education system. They wanted to make sure that people were immoral enough or lacked the morals and lacked the scruples to actually do what is right and do what they're told. Instead, we don't want you to do what's right. We want you to do what we tell you to do. And that you can do these things, and that these people over here that tell you you can't, and that you're violating these morals, these laws, and all these other things, they're the enemy. What? To be clear, those who are supporting our constitutional republic are being deemed as the enemy. Can you believe this? Yes. This is what the deep state has done because they've recognized who their greatest threat is in their grab for more and more power in stripping us from more and more of our liberties. So with that, I just throw it out there. I venture to say, my friends, that if you are wanting to see our constitutional republic saved, you have to take a stand. Don't worry. It's just like back in, you know, any type of scenario, whether it be King David or what have you, when one person stands, moral courage shoots through the crowd and other people will begin to stand with you. Don't worry about that. I truly believe that the blessings are here for us to seize if we actually act. And so there's no doubt in my mind, we cannot go. I mean, I'm blown away by how many Christians there are that espouse Christianity and talk about how, you know, how blessed they'll be if they do the right thing. There is nothing more congruent with Christianity than preserving individual liberty and individual sovereignty. The greatest threat to Christianity is subjugation, to allow the government to subjugate us. And so that's what we're facing. We're facing the ability of the government to all of a sudden regulate religion, regulate speech, because they're already standing on that precipice. they're already passing acts and measures of against hate speech. You know, that we're all voting against hate speech. Are you kidding me? I applaud hate speech because it's an individual privilege to be able to say what you want to say. Sticks and stones can break our bones, but words should and can never hurt us. And so with that, as we understand that, then we can move forward. Now, one of the things I've got to say is this show was sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. We also have that listen line that we want you to give to your friends. Tell them to call in during the time frame of this show. And we want you to ask them to, hey, just tune in and listen today. We're still going through the Constitution. We will not be done today. We may need more than a Constitution week to wrap this up just because of all the editorializing. So that listen number is 605-562-4209. And here's what you do. During the broadcasting of this show today, right now, as you're listening, send a text to somebody and tell them to, hey, call in 605-562-4209. Listen to what this guy is saying. This is a listen line. And listen to what this guy is saying and tell me what you think. Let's see if we can. It would be great to see if we could bring that number out of service because there's too many people dialing in. What we want to do is we want to get people to a point where they are coming to the well to drink, to expand their understanding of the Constitution and the simplicity of the fact that it is a contract and it is the state's contract and that the states have the authority and the ability to take a stand against the federal government. They should not be concerned because if the federal government actually comes after the states and stopping them in trying to coalesce together in calling the federal government out, if they tried to engage, that would be everything we would need. And I say that it would be everything we need because it would actually galvanize the people of the United States to say, wow, we do have a tyrannical government. They have no right and no authority to shut people down like that or to shut a state down. That is because if you want to call it a civil war, they are going to fight a civil war in trying to defend their unconstitutional government. The states have every right to stand up and say, you need to abide by our Constitution. That is not warfare over control. That is an application of authority over a contract. It becomes a civil war when those in the federal government pursue defending and taking control so that they can do what they want to do. So if you understand, the only way we would head into that, because I'm telling you, as soon as the federal government starts to apply that type of tyranny and that type of force in demanding that they can do whatever they want to do instead of the things that they've been delegated to do, that, I believe, would bring all the necessary citizens and patriots to the table. I mean, that would be the marketing we would need. I think that would motivate you, wouldn't it? If you saw the federal government actually dropping bombs on state capitals or attacking people in a state that is standing up and saying, you have no authority to do this. Okay, so the other thing I just wanted to mention real quick is we do have Red State Coffee. We ask, we plead to support this company and call 425-270-5416. And let us know what you think of Red State Coffee. We want you to help in supporting this show. And that's one thing you can do. Another thing, again, is hey, getting people to call in now to our listen line, 605-562-4209. Now, where we left off yesterday, we actually closed out on the enumerated powers. Section 9 are the absolute restrictions placed onto the federal government. And so the first one is actually an interesting restriction because it expires in 1808. In other words, the federal government was restricted from, you know, controlling the immigration of people into the United States until 1808. Then it assumes full control and authority over the regulating of people coming into the United States. So Section 9 starts off with this. And let me see. Let me pull it up here because I just want to make sure that as we look at this, is there subsections? Yes. So subsection 1, if you're looking at the Constitution, because I look at both the Constitution and the Avalon layout of the Constitution, subsection 1 is actually the language of Section 9. It starts off with the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be permitted by Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person. So the states had full control of people coming in and who they wanted to come into their state. And the majority and the real purpose of this was slavery and to end the slavery, but it was also that the states had the authority to control the migration and importation of people. Migration means people wanting to come there. Now, with that, we're at a hard break. We'll be right back with more of these restrictions after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue. Okay, so again, we just started with Section 9, which are the restrictions or the prohibitions placed on the federal government or the general government from being able to do certain things. And so the first thing they started off with was this restriction of controlling the migration of people into the states. The states had their own cognizance and authority for the first 20 years until 1808, and then the full control over immigration or the migration or importation of people into the United States fell unto Congress. So they're supposed to set up standards for the immigration process of individuals. Nowhere was there this concept of being able to migrate in a block group of people by the federal government. The intent was to actually stop that because that was slavery. And in context, they were allowing Africans in the southern states. And so this was a restriction for 20 years. And then the federal government was then in control, and they were to stop the states from being able to directly import and so forth. They also placed a tax on this. But anyway, the next one, the next restriction was the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. Now, there is a caveat to this and how this was defined to the states. And in the state of Virginia, Madison clarified this as that they could only, because this had to do with martial law as well. And they said that the only reason that they could do this is if the militia was deployed. Because if there is not a magnitude of significance that would require the militia to suppress a rebellion, in other words, local authority could do it, then the federal government could not call martial law and or even the suspension of habeas corpus. So these things are kind of intertwined with the militia, that the militia had to be called, and only in the states where the militia is one called and or serving in fighting and suppressing rebellion and or invasion. So in other words, martial law and the suspension of habeas corpus was not something that was done for the entire 50 states or even the North or what have you. It could only be applied where there was being the current service. So in Maine or up in New Hampshire or Massachusetts, were they under threat of invasion by the South? No. There were several states to the south of them that were engaged, but the warfare never came close to them. There was no need to suspend habeas corpus and or martial law, declare martial law up in those northern states. In other words, they didn't give a blanket authority to the federal government to just declare martial law for the United States, which means that this concept of the sovereign citizen and that the federal government declared martial law during the Civil War for the entire United States and has kept it on us is a violation of the terms of the contract as defined by the father of the Constitution himself during the legal process of defining the Constitution, or what we call the ratification debates. Got to understand this. This is very clear, folks. The federal government cannot do this. It was not defined. And all we need are states to step up and say, hey, look, you can't do that. Bottom line is you can only do it into the states where there is the rebellion, where the militia and or an invasion, where we're deploying the militia. And that's the only place where you can do that. Okay. So in the next one, subsection, let me make sure this is subsection 3 to 9. Yes. No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. Now, if you understand a bill of an attainder is a bill that actually puts a penalty and or a charge or finds somebody guilty of something, not just a person, but a group of people. In other words, the federal government cannot say people that are anti-homosexual can be considered hate crime people. That would be considered as a bill of attainder. It's the same thing as people that hate Christians or Christians that hate Jews or what have you. You cannot put, and the federal government was restricted from trying to create bills of attainder, in other words, carte blanche marking a group of people, whether that be Mormons, whether that be Islamist or what have you. They can't just, you know, throw out a bill of attainder and mark a class of people as criminals and or bad doers or what have you. The other thing is that they could not write ex post facto laws, period. The federal government could not pass a law and then say, boom, you know, if you do this, then this is what's going to happen. This came up during the 14th Amendment when they actually passed Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They all acknowledged that this could only be applied to future rebellions, that they, you know, could not apply this because then it would be an ex post facto law. And so here's the important thing of this, the 14th Amendment, Section 3. Section 3 was offering a more civil way of addressing people with rebellion, especially leaders in leading rebellions, by removing them from, you know, public service. And we've gone through this a lot, but I want you to understand it in this context to this particular restriction of an ex post facto law. They could not actually grant these, you know, this lesser penalty. Because bottom line, everybody that rebelled against the United States in seceding and actually declaring war against the United States, that was actually and could have been deemed as treason. However, the fact of the matter is the federal government had blood on their hands because they were guilty of violating the Constitution against the South. And the states literally just seceded. Those folks who actually declared war, which was Lincoln, he declared war against a non-aggressor. In other words, did Congress actually declare war? Did Congress? And so when you start looking at the Civil War and what really happened, the question is, how did it go down this path? And was it constitutional? And most people will realize that what we're being taught is not the facts, that is not the truth. Okay, so anyway, ex post facto laws, as far as I'm concerned and as far as you're concerned, they cannot pass a law that makes something that you did already illegal. And a great example of that is water rights. You own property, you bought land, and you had every intent in putting a well on that land so you could use that land for agriculture purposes or for living on or whatever. You need to have land. You know you have water underneath you. There's an aquifer, whatever, and you want to have access to that water. You put in a well. Well, they come along and they pass a law after you've bought that land, and they say you can't have wells on your land anymore. Well, that's an ex post facto law because they can only do that on future land purposes. Can you no longer have, if you want to buy land, you can no longer, if it doesn't have a well or what have you, you can't put one on there. They can't come along and make it illegal for you to put a water, you know, because it was legal beforehand for you to put a well on your land. Okay. So ex post facto laws was another tactic that King George and the Parliament and the tyrannical Britons were doing to people, and it was a historical thing. So they wanted to make sure that they were protecting us from the federal government and creating ex post facto laws. No tax no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Now, I may have mentioned this to you before, but Hamilton actually went down this path of trying to put a direct tax on the sale of horses. And it came down to the fact that not everybody had a horse, and some people had more horses than others. And it was viewed as a capitation or another type of direct tax that was not being proportioned to the people equally. In other words, certain people, if you didn't have horses, you weren't taxed. And what that meant was the people in the north, the northerners, didn't have horses. A lot of them didn't possess horses or only possessed one instead of many, like in the south, because the horses were tools of agriculture. And so what that was it was an unfair or an unproportionate tax that was being done. It was viewed that way. And that's why they did not go down the path of actually taxing those types of things. It has to be done proportionate so that each state and each citizen has the same burden. The next one, no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. Did you hear what I said? And I told you this before, that the federal government can tax imposts, they can have excise taxes and those types of things, but they cannot tax or lay duties on any articles exported from any state, regardless of where that's going. Let me be clear on this. When you put a tax on something, that does not necessarily mean that it is a revenue for the government. You can actually levy a tax on something by making constraints on, like, cars and, you know, their emission standards. That would be a tax that it would force the car manufacturer to have to manufacture to a standard. That in itself is a tax. So, when we come back, we'll dive into more of these restrictions on the federal government. Please stay tuned.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget to get those three C's, and if you're ready to call in, the lines are open. Okay, so do you remember we were talking about the regulation of commerce, right? And in the enumerated powers, it stated right there to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Well, guess what? In the restrictions placed on the federal government, the general government, they actually put a clarification of what this really meant. And it says here, no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another. In other words, they were to make sure that, and this was their responsibility and only this. This was not to allow them to dictate, you know, whether you could grow certain crops or whether you could control the production levels or anything like that. This was the clarification of how they were to regulate, that no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. In other words, the state of New York cannot use preference in how they were actually allowing commerce to flow into the United States. And as New York bringing it into their larger ports, being able to handle more commerce and so forth, being able to tax the recipient states on those goods that are coming through their port going to their state. And so to be clear, this is where the confinement of the Commerce Clause was placed. Okay? The next one, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. So in other words, they do annual reports and so forth, quarterly reports. But the fact is, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. In other words, they can't draw money, nor can they tax on anything other than what is legal, what is constitutional. And they're supposed to report what they're taxing for, what they're spending money on, and so forth. And they're violating this left and right because how much money is being spent on unconstitutional things? Welfare, that's not a law. That's not constitutional. Housing, that's not law. That's not constitutional. Parks and recreation, so forth and so on. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument. And so that means that you can't actually become the prince or the king of England while you're the president. You cannot be. And so you got to understand, a person and no person holding any office or profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And so this is a restriction that's placed on the individual offices and so forth. Now, what do you do if all of a sudden some title of nobility be granted to a person? Let's say, because of my heritage, I am recognized as the prince and potential king of England. Can I be elected to the presidency or any office? It says here, no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title. In other words, only while you're in that office can you be, let's say, bribed by saying, no, we're going to make you this. In other words, you can actually have, it doesn't say that you can't, but I mean, it would be pretty foolhardy of any American voter to vote for somebody that has an affinity or a tie and or a relation to a foreign state, period. I mean, it would be very stupid for us to try to vote for somebody and put them into office because they are under the emolument of a state. Now, I'm going to dive into Islam or Islamist really quick, because what is an imam? An imam is a title of nobility within the religion. And so can imams actually hold political office? Should they be able to? Or anybody that is, and you can put this into context with any type of church or religion, because as we understand, these are, especially when it comes to certain religions, there are levels of control and governance, because Islam is a form of governance. They create laws and you abide by those laws and they punish you if you do not. There's such a thing as Sharia law. And so we have these constitutional requirements and limitations, and it only makes sense that we don't even want to consider electing somebody that has the ability to affect, create, and enforce other laws and or have other influences in other sovereignties and foreign states, period. So why is it that we would think that it's wrong to do it with Britain, but it's okay to do it with a religion? Okay? All right. Now we're going into Section 10. And Section 10 are the restrictions placed on the states by the Constitution. In other words, okay, you're buying into this contract, and by doing so, here are some things that you cannot do, period. And so we will just dive into the very first one here. And it's kind of interesting because if you look at Section 10 in the Constitution, it just states out exactly what is the first thing. But these are subsections, and that's why I kind of like looking at Avalon, because subsection 1, or the first thing out the gate, is no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque, in other words, you know, go into an alliance for war or anything like that, which is what the South did, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment. So in other words, states can actually make gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder. In other words, they can't do what the federal government can do by creating a block violation, or, you know, a group of people, violators of the land, or wanted criminals, or what have you, if you subscribe to this, or what have you. And very similar to what's going on in China with the Falun Dong, how that was a bill of attainder where the government, the Chinese Communist Party, the government in control, had actually created it illegal to be a Falun Dong. And so states can't do that either. They can't pass any bill of attainder, or they cannot pass ex post facto laws or a law impairing the obligation of contracts or grants of any title of nobility. Did you hear that? So in other words, the states can't pass a law impairing the obligation of contracts or grant any title of nobility. So they can't impair any contracts, but they cannot, nor can they, grant any title of nobility. What is the governor? The governor is a position, but is it also not a title of nobility? Same thing with the president of the United States. And I think that they understood that the title of nobility being with a foreign entity and so forth. Anyway, that's just one of those things that, you know, we could easily wrap our mind into a twisted pretzel trying to understand what the grant and any title of nobility until you get into the ratification debates, because they talk a little bit about this. But most of these things that are just no-brainers are no-brainers. They knew what an ex post facto law was. They knew exactly what a bill of attainder was. And so there wasn't a lot of discussion regarding many of these things. Now, subsection 2 of Section 10, another restriction on the states, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any impost or duties on imports or exports except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. Now, we'll stop right there and say, okay, California has agricultural concerns because they produce a lot of agriculture. They don't want you to bring in an apple with a specific, you know, fly maggot or some type of thing that could harm their crops. So they can actually put imposts and or duties and or restrictions on the importation of very specific things just to make sure that they protect their products. Okay. So states can do that, but it's only as to be necessary and not to become a form of revenue. And so it can't be a moneymaker for them, like speeding tickets and buckling your safety belts and like what police do all the time. So anyway, We will be back. We'll finish subsection 2 of section 10 as soon as we come back. Thank you so much. Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so I want to point something out here with subsection 2. No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any impost or duties on imports. Now, a duty, again, or impost could be a burden. It doesn't have to be a direct tax. And so for California to have agricultural inspections and to make sure people and or companies and or states are not exporting or importing into their state something that would be harmful to their state, they have to have Congress's approval to do that, to have these agricultural inspections. If not, they are placing a duty without having the justification from Congress. And so anyway, the next in subsection 3 would be this. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty or tonnage, keep troops or ships of wartime in peace, enter into agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power to engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. And so this is basically keeping states from being able to get into foreign entanglements to be able to work with other states in waging their own little political war with Mexico and or military war or what have you. This is just another restraint that it just makes sense that the states would be prohibited on this external projection. Because, again, all things domestic were left for the states to enjoy, and everything of national security and external were the responsibilities of the federal government. And so with that, we have just successfully closed out Article 1 of the Constitution. The next section is Article 2, and this deals with the executive, the president. And so let's just go ahead and dive into Article 2. Section 1, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, to be elected as follows. Okay, so clearly they're saying that there is an elected president, and he is to serve for 4 years, and he will work together with the vice president, who has been chosen for the same type of term, for the same 4 years, and they are to be elected as follows. Now, you got to understand that the 12th Amendment actually changes this, but this first part is not changed by the 12th Amendment. Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress, but no senator, representative, or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. Now, so each state gets these are the Electoral College, and each state gets a very specific number of electors. It is based on your two senators as well as your representatives in the House. So Wyoming only has one, so they have three electors to choose. In the state of California, they have quite a few because they're the most populated state and has the most representation in Congress or in the House of Representatives. And so what this basically says is, in such a manner as the legislature thereof may direct, okay, so each state shall appoint in such a manner as the legislature thereof may direct. So the legislatures may direct of a selection or what have you, but they do not allow the Electoral College to be done by them. In other words, they're not the ones that are becoming the electors, because there's a prohibition that these people cannot be holding office or a position of trust or profit under the United States or even at the state level. Okay, so anyway, the state legislatures, basically they're going to dictate how the people will choose their electors. Then the next section is the part that is actually been amended by the Constitution. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons of whom, so this is not up to legislative control. In other words, this is not for the state to control. I want to be clear with this. State legislatures cannot tell how the ballots are to be done and how these votings and so forth are to be done. In other words, the electors shall meet in their respective states once they've been selected. So once the electors have been selected, then they meet in their respective state, and each of them will vote. It doesn't say that they have to vote for a party. It doesn't say they have to vote for a ticket. It says that in their respective states, and we're going to go straight into the 12th Amendment right after this, because I don't want to wait for a few months to go into this. I want to actually make A-B comparisons for you. And so, and the vote by ballot for two persons of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state. So in other words, if you're voting for president in your respective state, you can vote for, you're voting for a president and a vice president, and only one of them can be a resident of your state. You can't vote for two people that are residents of your state, okay? And so, and they shall make a list of all the persons voted for and of the number of votes for each. So it doesn't say that they're voting for a, you know, who is on the ballot. I want to be clear here. There is no limitations to who goes onto the ballot. They shall make a list of all the persons voted for, not voted on the ballot. Does this make sense? In other words, there is nowhere here where they say, well, the state legislatures will restrain and keep. No, When it comes to the presidential election, you can vote for anybody that may throw themselves into the ring and not have to be qualified, because it doesn't say anything about qualifications for parties. So anyway, and they shall make a list of the persons voted for and the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, to Washington, D.C., directed to the President of the Senate, which is the Vice President of the time. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the President, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. If there be more than one who have such majority and have an equal number of votes, in other words, if there's a tie, then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for president. So in other words, if you get two, then you go to a spoiler, and it's a down select to only the two, not everybody that was voted for. Okay. And so, let me see here. The House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for president. And if no person have a majority, then from the five highest on the list, the said House shall, in so they're basically saying it could go down to five people or even more than that, however many it's tied. Let's say there's 20 people. They will basically cut it down to who is the top five. Then from the five highest on the list, the said House shall in like manner choose the president, but in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote, a quorum. In other words, it will be done instead of the House of Representatives voting each. If it gets tied again, then it gets thrown into the states. So in other words, the California gets one vote for who they vote for. So it forces a real down select in how they're to vote. Anyway, each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states, and a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice. In every case, after the choice of the president, the person having the greatest number of votes of the electors shall be the vice president. In other words, after they choose who became president, the next greatest person that shows up in this race becomes the vice president. Did that say anything about a ticket? Did that say anything about a party? Of course not. No, it didn't. But if there should remain two or more who have equal votes, the Senate shall choose from them by ballot the vice president. So in other words, if after they finally boil it down to we get a president, but we still have a tie now for vice president, then it goes to the Senate for making the choice. Why? Because who's the vice president? The vice president is the president of the Senate, and that's how they choose that. Okay, so that was the part that was modified by the 12th Amendment. Now what we need to do is we actually need to go to the 12th Amendment so you can read or hear for yourself how this was changed and how whether or not this included the concept of, well, so as you can tell, we just ran out of time because just going through that took some time to editorialize, comment, and so forth. We're going to go through the 12th Amendment when we come back in our next episode. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. That way we can do an A-B comparison. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.